Amazon Grace by Mary Daly, Chapter 7, A Transtemporal Exchange of Information and Strategic Discussion. "Kate," I began, "I seem to be on the verge of asking you an important question, but it is really difficult to articulate." "Well, fire ahead anyway," she said, with an encouraging nod. So I plunged in. "You remember that during one of our 2048 BE encounters, you revealed that our lives were partially contemporaneous back then, in an archetypal dead time. I knew that you were a young woman who was interested in feminist philosophy and had read some of my work with great eagerness, but we had never met. From what you said, I got the idea that you were about 18 years old when I was completing the writing of Quintessence in Boston in 1998 AD. Kate, who was looking rather excited, said yes, and in that same year, since I was interested in the history of radical feminists, I thought I read the original selection of your first feminist book, The Church and the Second Sex, which you published in 1968. It was quite an experience. I remember it well. I was in my freshman year in college. My friends and I tried to get you to come and speak at our school during that academic year, 1998-99, but it seems like that didn't work out for you." Kate's gaze seemed to wander as if she was staring at something far away. Then she said, "It didn't work out for me either, because that was in the course of that academic year, after I became aware that I was pregnant with Annie, I joined some friends to form a network that we called Anonyma. We took off on a quantum leaping journey which led us to our discovery of lost and found continent." I was stunned and confused by Kate's brief allusion to her time-traveling adventures, but my attention was drawn to Anowa, who appeared to be calculating while scribbling figures in her notebook. "I get it," she said loudly. I started to say, "Well, I don't." However, I decided to continue with my narrative. The fall of 1998 marked the beginning of my final conflict with Boston College. It's interesting that this liberation from the confines of academia began to happen at the same time as your lusty leap to Lost and Found Continent and the bibliophilic era. "Sounds to me like an amazing transtemporal synchronicity," claimed Kate. "It certainly does," I agreed. Following a brief pause, Annie asked me, "So what happened next, Mary?" "Well," I answered, "by the winter of 1999, I was under assault, not for the first time, by the administration of Boston College. Those who followed my history with that institution recalled that when I was first fired in 1969 because of the Church and the Second Sex, which my employers found upsetting." Kate picked up the thread. "Weren't there lots of student demonstrations on your behalf in 69, as well as teach-ins and petitions about your case?" "Oh, yes, and weren't most of the demonstrators male students? Why was that?" "The reason for that was clear. Virtually all my students in the late 1960s were male." Anticipating her next question, I added, "You see, the Jesuit administration at Boston College did not admit women to the College of Arts and Sciences before 1970. Women were restricted to the School of Nursing and the School of Education." I hadn't realized that fact when I accepted the job offer from BC to teach courses in A&S in 1966. I really enjoyed teaching those young men, though. "They must have been very appreciative," said Kate. "I think that when they demonstrated and they petitioned for your behalf, they were also demonstrating that they had learned in your classes. They were publicly and colorfully asking whether their university was a place for the free exchange of ideas or whether it was enclosed by the church. During those months of public actions and the attendant publicity, you were recognized as a cause célèbre and a symbol of academic freedom." "Well, Kate, it appears that you learned that history quite well," I remarked. "My question to you is, where did you learn all this? You stated that you took off for Lost and Found Continent during your freshman year in college." "Sure I did," Kate responded, "but that was fall of 1998. I found a number of newspaper clippings from the late 1960s about your history at BC, and they were good sources of information. So also was your autobiographical preface to the 1975 edition of The Church and the Second Sex, as well as your 1992 autobiographical work, Outer Course. So you're well informed in many dimensions, Kate," I commented Riley. I take that statement as a signal to go on, said Kate. So your students' protests and the enormous publicity which they generated, together with the widespread influence of the church and the second sex, resulted in victory for you in the summer of 1996. The newspaper said that you were promoted to the rank of associate professor and awarded tenure that summer. That certainly was a tumultuous time for you, Mary, wasn't it? Did that experience change your thinking? Yes, absolutely it did, Kate. It radicalized me profoundly. Although that was a great victory, I had come to see through the grim grasp of patriarchy, not only at Boston College, but at all universities and throughout society. As I wrote in 1975, my concern was no longer limited to equality in the church or anywhere else. I did not really care about unimaginative reform, but instead began dreaming new dreams of a women's revolution. This was becoming a credible dream because a community of sisterhood was coming into being, into being. In the hearing-slash-healing presence of these sisters, I had grown ready to try writing-slash-speaking new words. Kate looked at me intensely. Well, your dream of a women's revolution was realized, at least to a great extent, wasn't it? Sure, Kate, I said, and it's still being realized by many we both know. On a day-by-day, year-by-year level, though, it wasn't so simple. In 1970, Boston College began to admit women to its College of Arts and Sciences. I knew there would be further battles. The university continued to be threatened by my books and speeches, not to mention my feminist philosophy and ethics courses and my policy since the early 70s of teaching women and men in separate sections for those courses. So they continued to harass me for three more decades, but I had a lot of fun fighting them back. Kate pursued her own train of thought. But surely those three decades held many traumatic experiences for you. From what I've read, I know that you were constantly under attack by the administration, even though you had many loyal student supporters, female and male, over those years, and always managed to win and to have fun, as you said. That's right, Kate, I responded. But in 99, exactly 30 years after my first struggle, I was disappeared from my job at Boston College, where I'd been teaching since 1966. Kate stared at me in horror. How in the world could that have happened? She gasped. By that time, Kate, the political-slash-social-slash-intellectual climate in America was infested by negative, greedy, power-mongering forces. The extreme right-wing Republicans were taking over. To use a trite but apt phrase, the times had changed. I could not have known back at the time of my celebrated victory in 1969 that after 30 more years of fights and triumphs at that institution, another series of events would happen, bizarrely comparable to the original scenario. But I did know, through the intervening years, that my task was to survive and thrive on the boundary of that university, consistently refusing them the false loyalty they tried to demand of me. I raved on. At both of these times of crisis, my identity as a university professor at Boston College, and indeed the possibility of continuing my life's work, were being targeted for destruction. In the later attack, a potentially lethal attempt was made to throw me off balance, to destroy my capacity for proprioception, that is, reception of stimuli produced within the organism. In other words, I was being challenged to find a new sense of balance, a new sense of where I am in space. Kate was wide-eyed. Hold on, Mary, you're racing ahead of me. Could you be more specific? What happened exactly? Right you are, Kate, I said. Catching my breath, I set forth some facts. On the afternoon of December 8, 1998, I received a frantic phone call from the chair of the theology department. I could hardly listen to him since I was rushing to finish my class preparation and then dash over to teach my 4:30 class, so I asked him to call me again the next day. On the following day, I learned from him that a male undergraduate student who had attempted in September to register in my class Introduction to Feminist Ethics without having the prerequisites would be in my class in January 1999 with or without my consent, whether or not he had completed the course prerequisites. The chair, who sounded nervous and terrified, hastily explained that this student was backed by an ultra-right law firm in Washington, D.C., known as the Center for Individual Rights, CIR. Citing Title IX, the federal legislation intended to provide women with equal access to educational resources, the student, a pro bono client of the CIR, was threatening a lawsuit against Boston College for sex discrimination. Kate was stunned. But Mary, how could they have pulled that off? As you know, I was a college student at that time, just before I took off for Lost and Found Continent. I was quite aware of the meaning and importance of Title IX for women's equality. I assumed that almost all educated people knew what that meant. I attempted to explain this instance of reversal. The CIR fellows used Duane, who was the leader of the young Republicans on campus. They were cynically taking advantage of the conditions of heightened right-wing backlash, including the climate of doublethink and reversal, which of course they promoted. For about 25 years, I'd had a classroom policy of teaching women and men separately in my feminist ethics classes. I developed this method during the early 1970s after I saw the dulling of women's participation in what occurred in mixed classes. Of course, I never refused to teach a student, male or female, who expressed interest and had completed the course prerequisites. "It's clear that you were acting in accordance with the intent of Title IX," said Kate. "Of course I was," I said. "In fact, the duplicitous CIR openly opposed Title IX, calling it one of feminism's sacred cows. They specifically targeted individual radicals and feminist initiatives, such as the Federal Violence Against Women Act." "It's obvious that Boston College knuckled under to that right-wing law firm," said Inawa. "I'd say it's obvious that they were more than willing to knuckle under," exclaimed Annie. "It seems that the CIR tried to help BC to achieve what they had tried and failed to do in 30 years of sustained effort." "Well, yes," I said, "but the important point is that they tried and, on the deepest level, failed again. Here's what happened. In a stunning and underhanded move, BC agreed to settle with the CIR in the fall of 1998, before a single paper was filed, and without any notice to me. I later saw a copy of the CIR letter to the president of Boston College, which curiously was dated October 16th, which happens to be my birthday. Their secret demands included the stipulation that the student would be registered in my spring 1999 feminist ethics class, despite his lack of the women's studies prerequisite and without my consent. This was not unconnected to the fact that BC was under increasing pressure to conform to Vatican rulings and affirm its own orthodoxy and fidelity to Catholic teachings, while at the same time pretending to champion an open environment and academic freedom. It all sounds typically patriarchal, so slimy and convoluted and basically deceptive. "Yuck," exclaimed Nasrin, who was usually very quiet. Some ducks began quacking. Their quack sounded to me like a series of yucks. Apparently, I was not alone in my odd perception, because a group of women began laughing and then broke into a chorus of yucking. "Sounds like a band of yuck ducks," commented Sophie. "Maybe they should call themselves the Yuck Duck Chorus." Fenrir howled her approval. "Enough with this silliness," announced Kate. "Mary must continue her grim account." I went on. By January 1999, I came to the conclusion that the best way to avoid the trap of being forced to admit the imposter into my class would be to take a leave of absence for that semester and begin work on my next book. I was interrupted by loud cheers. I then continued presenting the facts to my increasingly rowdy but still attentive audience. The administration at first appeared amenable to granting my request for leave, but soon used this proposal as an opportunity for luring me into meetings in the office of the Vice President for Human Resources, who enjoyed a reputation for employing inquisitorial tactics. The ostensible purpose of the required meeting was to discuss the conditions of my leave. My attendance was presented as a sine qua non for obtaining the leave. Despite my misgivings under protest, I agreed to participate in two meetings in January in the desperate hope of obtaining my leave. I realized that the situation was treacherous. It smelled worse than just fishy. It smelled bad. Point in my account, my feline friends, who were crouching near me, began hissing slowly. Cotty, who was in attack mode, leaped forward, wild-eyed, charging at something that was invisible, to me at any rate. but whose negative presence could be sensed by all of us. Her attack worked as an exorcism, and something appeared to slither and glide away from our space. Fenrir howled. I'm feeling chilled, said Annie. I can't seem to stop shivering, said Anawa. Mary, please hurry and finish your account, Kate said tersely. I continued. In a panic during one of these meetings, I must have blurted out something like, I'd rather resign than teach under these conditions, and they jumped at this chance to take me at my word. It soon became evident in the course of these meetings that the administration had no intention of granting me a straightforward leave of absence, but was intent upon forcing me to sign a retirement agreement. The agreement contained a lengthy and convoluted confidentiality clause, in other words, a gag order. I was interrupted by a resounding cacophonous interlude from the Yuck Duck chorus. When the yucking faded, I forged ahead. In the face of some blatant attempts at psychological arm-twisting by the administration, I refused adamantly to sign any such agreement. Again, there was an interruption, this time consisting of meows, cheers, honks, oinks, roars, moos, neighs, barks, whistles, trills, cackles, and more. Overwhelmed by this wonderful show of support, I thanked everyone. Thank you, thank you, thank you, I said. Kate stood up and signaled for silence. She nodded to me to continue. In February 1999, I began in earnest to search for a good lawyer. My efforts were rewarded. I found a civil rights attorney who was a feminist activist who agreed to represent me in my struggle against Boston College. I filed a lawsuit against the university for breach of contract, for constructive discharge, and for violation of my academic freedom and tenure rights. Anawa spoke out, but you knew that the legal system was hopelessly phallocratic. Of course I did, I yelled, and that's why I always had used other ways of fighting back. But the time of great massive demonstrations was over. The late 90s was the beginning of a period of dulled out, draining, dead-headed daddydom. So the weapon at hand was their paralyzing patriarchal legal system, which I hated. Women groaned. Cats and snakes hissed. A group of monkeys screeched. Fenrir bared her teeth and snarled. I carried on. In the spring of that year, the administration continued its outrageous assault. BC brazenly and deceitfully proclaimed that I had resigned. One administrator came to a meeting of the theology department, from which I was absent, and publicly announced this disinformation. My name and course listings were removed from the university catalog, and pre-registration materials for the academic year 1999 and 2000. All this was done without notice to me and without the due process guaranteed to me as a faculty member with tenure. I'm beginning to feel those chills again, said Annie. Her comment was echoed by others who seemed to be unconsciously huddling closer together. It was not until the end of the 20th century, the time when the ultra-conservative takeover of power in the U.S. and in the Catholic Church was rapidly encroaching, that they had reached the point of savagely and illegally disappearing me. The tenure that the BC administration had grudgingly granted to me in 1969 in response to the demand from thousands of their students, alumni, and other concerned persons was flagrantly violated by the administration. BC broke the promise made by the university to their students, as well as the promise inherent in tenure itself. They believed that they could get away with this ruthless act. I could not let them get away with it. The animals and women stood up. After a moment of silence, Sophie said simply, "And we here on Lost and Found did not let them get away with it." "Oh, absolutely. Thank you," I said. "Of course, you were present as magnetic attractors, guiding me, guiding and guarding all of us in your pursuit of the final cause." "Will you say more about how that worked itself out?" asked Kate. "I mean, what about the experiences involved, the specifics of losses and victories?" "I'd be happy to describe these," I said, "but first I want to acknowledge the context of such struggles for radical feminist Amazons. First, as you know, I am aware that I am the center of this story slash adventure insofar that it is my own story. As Amazonian adventurers, we are all at the center of our own stories, yet they all overlap as we move into participation in the powers of the goddess Nemesis, who is the true center of our converging adventures. Her work, which is also our work, is elemental disruption of the patriarchal balance of terror. At the same time, it is passionate spinning slash spiraling of archaic threads of gynergy. Now, in response to your question about my own experience of being disappeared from Boston College in the spring of 1999 and the atrocities leading up to this, I can say that it was a compound traumatic event. To be more precise, it involved a complex series of shocks, each of which had multiple layers that interacted with each other. I could not understand immediately all that was happening. I sensed that it had something in common with gang rape. To explain this institution, I now call upon a word from the Wiccadary named rapism. What they perpetuated against me was an act of rapism, which means the fundamental ideology and practice of patriarchy characterized by invasion, violation, degradation, objectification, and destruction of women and nature, the fundamental paradigm of racism, classism, and other oppressive isms. Since this manifestation of rapism was not simply physical, it was hard at first to name its multiple levels of invasion, violation, degradation, and destruction, and the horror of this. These levels can be glimpsed only when one recognizes that I was not the only target of this maneuver. "I get it," said Anawa. "By invading and violating your classroom and taking away your job, they were trying to shut you up and destroy the possibility of women's space at that school. As far as their tentacles could reach. Yuck." As if on cue, the Yuck Duck Chorus started yucking. As before, Kate assumed the role of maintaining order. "Quiet!" she shouted. After the women in the chorus settled down, the ducks in the pond continued to carry on. "You too!" she yelled at them. When silence was restored, Anawa boldly raised her hand, waving at me imploringly. What do you think, Anawa?" I said. "I just want to make one of my most important points. When all the, noise began," she said emphatically, "I want to point out that your women-only classes appear to me to have been like anticipations of what we have here at Lost and Found Continent all the time. And without the disgustingly hostile environment of BC. Did you have something like 4 glimpses of Lost and Found during those 25 years? "Well, Anawa, that raises important questions about transtemporal understanding and travel, doesn't it?" I responded. "I didn't make my first voyage to Lost and Found until 1998 AD, when Annie invoked me. Of course, it was then 2048 BE on Lost and Found. I must have had some subliminal 4 glimpses, as you so nicely put it. There are traces and signs of such subliminal knowledge, but I don't think I can answer the question further than that." I continued. "I've been working about how the Anonima Network members, our future Four Sisters, have been pulling us along, magnetizing us. This magical interaction is part of the magnetic magic that Annie wrote about in her preface to the 2048 edition of Quintessence. Just thinking about it makes me feel quite spacey." At that moment, everyone gasped. I didn't know what all the gasping was about until I was told later that after Anawa's question, I momentarily disappeared. I recall hearing someone say, "This is exactly like what happened at the end of her visits in 2048 BE. Annie, especially, found that disconcerting." When I heard Annie's plaintive voice, "Yes, it is disconcerting. There's always so much more to say." It seemed that after Annie's comment, I immediately reappeared and was seen sitting in the same place as if nothing had happened. I heard another gasp and innocently asked what was going on. "You tell us," said Annie. "Don't you know how it is very unnerving when you suddenly leave like that? You did that in 2048 BE, but this time you left and then suddenly came back." I apologized profusely and tried to explain. "You see, what was going on for me was that first I was puzzling over Anawa's question, and so I became sort of lost in thought, as it were. Then I was suddenly shaken by hearing Annie's voice complaining, 'There's so much more to say.' I was thinking specifically about the importance of women's space and how much I long to be here with you. So I guess that thought and that longing sort of snapped me back, I mean, ahead. So, hi," I added feebly. We all sort of laughed and cried at the same time. Fenrir simply trotted over to me and put her paw on my shoulder. Anawa said what we were all thinking. "Fenrir just made the most enlightening demonstration and comment about women's space. She's saying it's the animals who make it possible." After much appreciative roaring, mooing, cheering, snarling, twittering, etc., we all stood up and stretched, getting ready for our next big discussion.